Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for our second program of Purple House, a monthly forum for the arts. I'm your host, Robert Tomlinson, and with me today in the studio, Richard Sandler. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
I'm glad you're here. So, first thing, I guess part of what's exciting is you have a brand new book out called The Eyes of the City. Can you give us a description of the book?
Yes, the book starts in 1977 and it ends in 2001. These are street photographs, principally of New York City, but there's probably, out of 116 pictures, I think there's like 12 of them, or 14 of them actually, mm-hmm. that are from Boston, which is where I started street photography in 1977. So basically this was my heyday, shall we say, as a street photographer, and that kind of abruptly ended in New York City after 9/11.
Okay. We'll talk about that. Before we do that, I'd like to ask you about this quote from Robert Frank, who said, "It's always the instantaneous reaction to oneself that produces a photograph." How do you respond to that?
There's a lot one could say about that, but just maybe from a diaristic sense, every picture is about you. You go out and you shoot a couple of rolls of film, whatever it is, and you come home and you make contact sheets. This is obviously old school. I'm not talking about digital. And you look at these contact sheets and they're, it's like a page in your diary. That's what you saw that day. That's what you looked at. And if you let yourself go with it, it can be a kind of almost automatic writing. If you respond to your impulses and don't censor them, you can get a pretty interesting visual readout of what otherwise might be in a diary written down.
So I'm wondering how the photographs, or how you, started this project. Did you just go out on the street and just decide, I'm going to take pictures? Or did you pick a specific neighborhood that you had seen before and go at a specific time to try and attract a specific image? Which came first? Or is it both?
Actually, that and more. I was very fortunate to live in a very sort of fertile artistic environment when I started photography, and was helped enormously by people that gave me a camera, gave me advice, and generally supported my new career or whatever, my new endeavor, which was going to be photography. Previous to that, I had been a natural foods chef and involved greatly in the beginning of the natural foods movement, which I would place at about 1967 to 8. And then I became an acupuncturist and practiced acupuncture for many years. And in that period of time, is when I began photography towards the end of practicing acupuncture.
So do you have any specific feelings about the question of what makes a good photograph?
Well, there are as many answers to that question as there are good photographs. The beautiful thing is it's a sort of je ne sais quoi,
Right.
I mean, it's such a wonderfully inventive medium, know. The uniqueness, comes out of it every single day, right?
Would you agree that a bad photograph could actually be a good photograph?
Well, if you mean bad in the sense that bad means good, like bad.
Well, I'm thinking of a lot of maybe technologically. Sometimes, things look like they're not like completely, up to par, but somehow they have a magic to them, and they turn out to be a kind of a revelation of their own right.
It's very hard to know, I mean, photographs can be extremely complicated, where there's a lot going on, where I would say there's like three or four or five or six balls in the air at the same time, a juggling match of competing and complementary, density, shall we say. But on the other hand, one can make an incredible portrait, which is just one person, and see into the soul of that person through the photograph. And so that's every bit as satisfying. So, it really runs the gamut, and there really are no rules.
So are there any ethical considerations to photographing people, strangers, in public? Is there a point where you might have felt that you were crossing a boundary, or do you feel like sometimes you need to ask permission? How does that work for you if you're out on the street working?
I rarely ask permission, rarely if ever have asked permission. I'm interested in capturing moments that, are, to my eye, to my sensibility, tending towards being unique. I'm looking for things that, really make my photo meter rise, yeah, shall we say, you know?
And are a lot of the photographs then happenstance, chance?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, most of them are. Uh-huh. I mean, the best ones are absolute gifts from the photo gods.
Yeah.
You know, they say, here, give Sandler a photograph. You know, he needs it. You know, keep him involved because it's extremely hard. Mm-hmm. To make good photographs, it's not easy at all. It's deceptively easy. Mm-hmm. Photography of all the art forms has the easiest entrance point. Mm-hmm. Doesn't require a lot of study to hit the street and start photographing. Like if you want to play Bach, you know, and you're just starting out on the cello, you're going to sound terrible, or the violin or whatever, for right. quite a while before right. you sound good.
Right.
So photography doesn't have that kind of a curve. You can get right into it yeah. and get lucky and take the best picture of your whole life.
Yeah.
In fact, that kind of happened to me. And there was one picture that I, you know, it was lucky. The camera was even broken. And so the shutter speed was too fast, but everything came out wonderfully. And from that, from my mistakes, from my awkwardness, I found a path that I wanted to go down. So that's the beauty of photography. Since you can make so many photographs, you can learn from the mistakes and take, you know, the parts of those mistakes and turn those things that do work into something of a vocabulary.
So you mentioned entry point. So since the photo on the telephone, so to speak, or the cell phone has come into being for so many people, it seems like there is a kind of a democratization of photography for the masses. How do you see that in terms of influencing contemporary photographers or yourself?
Yeah, I do occasionally use the cell phone, not very often, but once in a while. I certainly am not into it, quote unquote. I way prefer shooting film, but occasionally a cell phone photograph I will take. But how has it influenced? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it has made the whole, it has made the entrance point into photography even easier, of course, and requiring, you know, no brains whatsoever, which is, you know, both okay, because, yes, you can just get in there and take a picture, but at the same time, you don't really know what you're doing, so you don't know how to adjust light to, you know, achieve a vision that you might have. Mm-hmm. For instance, you know, taking a picture with the aperture of the lens closed down with a very high shutter speed can make day for night. You can make daytime look like nighttime, okay? You can't do that with a cell phone because you can't operate it manually. So there's a much smaller slice of what's possible using a cell phone as compared to using a, you know, a sophisticated camera with apertures and shutter speeds.
So you prefer film?
Yeah.
And are you shooting film now?
Yeah.
And do you have a darkroom?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I develop my film and print my pictures by myself in my darkroom here in Catskill, NY.
How wonderful.
Yeah.
So you had mentioned the book only goes up to a few years ago, that you sort of stopped with street photography, is that correct?
Yeah, 2001 is already 16 years ago.
Yeah.
I know, time marches on.
So what's your focus since then?
Films. I've been making, since 92 I started making documentary films, videos and films, I should say. I made three documentaries about New York City. It was kind of a trilogy, you might say. One was about the end of the old Times Square called The Gods of Times Square. Did you see it?
No, I haven't. Sorry.
Okay. And then one called Brave New York. So this is a sort of ironic view of the East Village and what's happened to it and how it's been gentrified and turned into a yuppie hellhole. And can we say that on the radio?
Sure.
Hell?
All right.
Say hell all you want. Yeah. So, and then the third one is called Sway, which is about the subway. And so those three were made back to back to back. And then 9/11 happened, and I couldn't shoot still photography anymore because still photography is too romantic, too quaint, too perfect. You know, you're looking for perfection. And on that day, you know, it was such a wipeout. It was such a human, horrible sort of wipeout of all kindness and so I just couldn't photograph. I had to shoot video. So from that day forward, it's become mostly video and film. And then starting in 99, I started shooting Super 8 and 16 millimeter and 35 millimeter film for a documentary that has been completely shot, sound recorded, and it's ready to be edited. Mm. It's called AKA Martha's Vineyard.
Mm.
And it's the history of Martha's Vineyard as only told from the point of view of the Wampanoag tribe on Martha's Vineyard, who have been there for tens of thousands of years, probably even when it was covered with ice. But that's their place. So I've been going to Martha's Vineyard for over 40 years, and I have very dear friends in the Wampanoag tribe, and they have helped me greatly in this. But it's expensive to bring to, you know, the world, because it's shot on film, and film needs to be scanned. Since so much of it's on Super 8 film, it can't be cut. That is to say, physically cut the way, you know, I could do with the 16 and 35, but the Super 8 can't be cut. It has to be essentially digitized, you know, at a very high rate of, you know, perception, shall we say.
So please tell us the title again, AKA?
It's called AKA Martha's Vineyard.
Okay.
And then I'm also working on one here in the Hudson Valley, which has been going on for a number of years as well, because I used to live west of Woodstock for 2 years. But that one is it's untitled at the moment, but it's a history of the contact between the river, indigenous nations, and the Dutch, and what the Dutch did in, you know, clearing New Netherland out, essentially, of native people as much as they possibly could, so that there are very, very, very few native people living in the Hudson Valley. There are Iroquois, you know, the five, six nations in upper New York State, western New York State. But right around here and from here down, you know, all the way down the Hudson, there are very, very, very few native people, because they either died from the white man's diseases, or they were run out on various trails of tears to places like Michigan. And so the remnants of those tribal nations from around here are now living there.
Very serious work.
Yeah.
And timely.
Yeah, exactly.
Very good.
Yeah, thank you.
As an artist, how do you internalize people's comments about your work? I noticed someone said, I think in writing about the new book, these are sad photographs. What does that mean for you? Or does it affect you in some way? Do you take that into account when you work? Do you just let it go?
Good question. Yeah, they are sad photographs. And the reason why they're sad is because I, as I'm shooting them, am acutely aware of the disconnect between the, you know, lofty ideals, which, by the way, come directly from the, you know, Iroquois. And
to tell us about that. What do you mean directly from the Iroquois?
Well, Benjamin Franklin was very interested, enamored, and blown away by the democratic form of government that had been existing in the, it's called the Haudenosaunee, but the, you know, the word people know them by is Iroquois, which was a compact of five tribes and then six in the contact era. But this compact of five tribes pre-existed, I mean, predated, I'm sorry, the arrival of Europeans by between 5 and 1500 years. Nobody really knows. So,
because there's no written record?
Yeah, it's just oral history, and unfortunately, most of the people died.
Yeah.
You know, oral history is the best way to preserve history, as long as people don't die prematurely, right?
And that there's a way to tell the story.
Yeah, and there are people around to even tell it too.
Right.
I mean, the backdrop of the Thanksgiving story is that the Wampanoags that were living on the Cape were almost 100% of them were almost dead. It was there was like 95% of them had died from various epidemic diseases of European origin.
That's a huge tragedy.
But anyway, all that to say that Franklin lived with and studied with the Seneca, which is one of the five original tribes of the Haudenosaunee. And they had their own violence problems, certainly not on the level.
With other tribes or amongst themselves?
Yes, right, within themselves, mostly with other neighboring tribes. And so there were blood feuds that really upset them greatly. And then there was born a man, a peacemaker, and he had this vision of, you know, all five of the tribes being connected at their roots, you know, each one a different tree. Very much like the, there's a lot of trees like that, like, for instance, what do you call them? Beetlebungs. You know, beetlebungs. It looks like there's a lot of trees, but
it's
they're all connected at the root. They're all connected at the root. It's very common in nature, obviously, for trees to, you know, share root systems. Anyway, so they conquered their violence problems, and they created a form of government which was both federal in the sense that they were all belonged to one sort of polity,
mm-hmm.
but also you still belonged to your tribe. So you were a member of your tribe. That was the state, mm-hmm. essentially, mm-hmm. that you lived in. And then you lived in this overarching, you know, sort of federal government, which mm-hmm. was the compact of all five. And then there was the fact that there were clans mm-hmm. that went from one tribe to the next. So you could be part of a bear clan or an eagle clan or a wolf clan or a turtle clan. Mm-hmm. And so you would have brothers and sisters that were also, you know, I should say brothers and sisters in arms, shall we say, mm-hmm. that were, mm-hmm. you know, members of other tribes that were part of that clan as well. And the clan mothers, the heads of the clans were all female, not male. And the females chose the chiefs, whether they be male or female. Uh-huh. So it was a world uh-huh. that was way more egalitarian between men and women.
And this is something that Franklin was very impressed
yeah,
with and informed him on how to support creating a new democracy
exactly.
in this new country.
Exactly. And so this was adopted into the Articles of, you know, adapted, I should say, mm-hmm. into the Articles of Confederation, which didn't last long because it required unanimity, mm-hmm. it required consensus, and they couldn't mm-hmm. deal with that, the fledgling colonies,
mm-hmm.
And then it became the United States Constitution, which only required 51% or
right.
anything over 50.
Right.
So anyway, that's my spiel.
Okay, I'm totally fascinated. We're going to have to invite you to come back. We have lots to talk about. But let me invite folks to go down to Magpie Bookshop
yep.
to see Richard's new book. It's wonderful. And they're on Main Street in Catskill, and you can also find Magpie on their website address, which is www.magpiebookshop.com. Richard, thank you so much for
thank
being here.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you.
You have a great radio voice, brother, and I know that.
I think you're the one.
My mother was in radio, so I know all about it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.